Board Game Bros.
Or should I say Board Game Bros? Because it's nearly Halloween, and hello, listeners. My name is Jeffrey Craig.
I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is the podcast Board Game Bros, where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming, game design, all things fun and gaming.
And, I apologize that neither of us figured out the Board Game Bros joke until now.
Yeah, well, we figured it out.
In retrospect.
I don't regret it. I both don't regret having taken so long to say it, and I don't regret saying it as well.
Yeah.
I have zero regrets over here. It's the Board Game Brothers podcast, and we talk about board games, and it is the last Saturday of the month where normally with our podcast, we will pick one board game and we'll get into the details of the gameplay and the strategies and then the game design. But on the last Saturday, we like to pick a topic that is a little more broad, and we like to dissect that instead and talk about that topic as it relates to board games and board gaming. Sometimes we choose a mechanic in board games, and sometimes we choose a genre of board games. And today we have chosen a genre. Matthew, what genre are we discussing today?
It's like part genre, part mechanic. We are talking social deduction
games. Social deduction games.
And I think this is very October appropriate because, in a way, most of the horror in horror board games, it seems like, comes from social deduction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, humanity is the real evil.
Yeah, it comes from paranoia and suspicion. So, Matthew, what I have my definition of what a social deduction board game is. So I will read it. How about that?
Sure, yeah.
So what I have written is a social deduction game involves as a central theme having to discern hidden information, and being able to do so successfully will lead to winning, or tricking others to do so wrongfully will also lead to winning. So essentially there's something that not everybody knows. Maybe you know it. You're just trying to use that information to your advantage.
Right.
Or trick people into thinking the wrong thing.
Really, the genre name is pretty self-descriptive. It involves deduction and social elements.
Yeah. And
social play.
Later in the episode, I would like to bring up just how much social and just how much deduction is important and necessary for a social deduction board game. But for now, let's get into the details of a social deduction genre and mechanic. Yeah. So I think the first thing that could be said is that, like, technically any game could involve some amount of social deduction or socializing.
Even games without hidden information like chess or Go, they're still, you know, trying to read your opponent, trying to figure out what play style they have.
Right. Usually in a game, in any given game that isn't designed to be a social deduction game, most of the victory that you obtain, most of the advantages that you obtain in the game and the way that you win is played out through the game's mechanics and the game's pieces, and doesn't usually involve any amount of talking, conversing with other players.
Right, yeah. Social deduction games are kind of unique in that they almost always have a larger focus on everything outside of the game's mechanics,
mm-hmm.
and most of the interaction comes outside of the game's mechanics,
right,
or components,
right,
or pieces.
I think just the big discerning factor is that word social, where the talking is very important in the game, and it can inform a lot of other parts of the game.
The other players, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, you could play a game. Like, you could play Catan. Well, I guess Catan has a lot of talking to it. Maybe that's a bad example. You could play, like, Dominion, and you can talk with the other players, and you can say, like, oh, I'm going to do that, or my strategy is this, or I think your strategy is this, but you know, it doesn't really stop them at all from doing whatever they were planning on doing anyways.
Right.
A social deduction game, it's necessary that you talk and try and figure out the meaning behind people's words.
Right. Usually the players themselves have a very large influence on the rest of the game's components or pieces or what's the word? Parts? Aspects? Anyways, players have a much larger influence on the game's parts than the mechanics do or other mechanical interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, like Dominion, you can't buy cards unless you have the money for them or stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
where the mechanics have a much larger say in what you do or how it plays out.
Right. And I think one of the most simplest ways to achieve this player autonomy or this player influence on the flow of a game is by having very few mechanics to begin with.
Right.
And whatever mechanics you do have usually involve players voting or declaring things.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, let's go over, maybe let's go over a couple social deduction games that we are familiar with that we may have played and sort of go over how simple rules can be.
Right, yeah. So I want to start with, I think, the prime social deduction game, which mm-hmm. is, of course, poker.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely.
So, yeah. So, I mean, this is the one that has a professional circuit and everything. So from my limited understanding of, like, the strategy involved in it, one thing they do to make players need to guess is they make it so that, like, in a Nash equilibrium where all information is open and every player knows every other player's information, it's bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
So they make it so that if everyone were to know everybody's hand, it's probably worse for you. So they both require you to hide your hand in some way, as well as discern others. They also have really one major player action, a couple major player actions involving, like, you know, folding, calling, raising, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And these all pretty much use the same resource, which is chips. And so they have one resource that can be interacted with in a few simple ways. And everything else comes through, like, the implications of those.
Yeah, it comes through, like, why are they raising? Why have they raised as much as they have raised?
Right. Usually, if you have one resource, it tends to be really important and take a big focus. And so, I mean, especially because poker, you know, you play it in a casino, it's real money. But, like, I think the big part is that since chips carry so much weight to them just inherently, then any actions done with the chips are also very weighty.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you'll see in a lot of other games, is that their resources in the game that are, like, actual game resources are very open-ended in terms of what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
As much tools to bluff with as your own mouth.
Now, poker is interesting. I guess in the highest level, there's hardly any socializing.
Right.
From my limited experience. I mean, I've seen
games where people try to, you know...
Yeah, I've seen games where people, they walk around and they talk and they say little comments on the side. Mm-hmm. But it seems like at the very highest play, people are very, like, reserved. People wear hats and sunglasses to hide their expressions even. That is a good example of, like, the original social deduction game. In a similar vein, there's another game that uses chips as one of its alternative game elements, other than, like, the initial cards that you are guarding that are hidden information. That is Coup. Coup was designed by Riki Tejada and published by Indie Boards and Cards, who have published a lot of social deduction games, Indie Boards and Cards. In that game, there's a deck of 15 cards, And in that deck, there are three copies of five different, I think in the game they're called roles or influences. I can't remember.
I think they were called like influence cards.
Influence cards, right. And each influence card has a character and it has a special action to it. So there's three copies of five different cards that each have their own unique actions to them. And everyone is dealt two cards from this deck. And everyone is given two chips. And each of these cards has actions that involve taking chips from other players, spending chips to accomplish some sort of task, or doing something with these influence cards, like revealing them for other players or getting new ones. And the game revolves around using these influence card actions, but you're only given two. So you can only prove that you have two of them, but you're allowed to take any of their actions in the game. You're allowed to take any of those five cards' actions. So the game revolves around using the actions of cards that you don't have and getting away with it, while also identifying when your opponents have used actions that they don't have access to and calling them out for it.
Right.
And so that game involves, if you get called out for it, you have the option of proving that you, in fact, had that action available to you by revealing that influence card and then shuffling that card away into the deck and drawing a new one. Or
right,
and if you if you don't have that action available, or if you don't want to reveal that you have that action available, then you lose one of your influence cards. And the game ends when you run out of influence cards. So right. The influence cards are almost, if you compare it to poker, they're playing like the chips in that when you run out of them, you lose. But they're also similar to the cards in that they're hidden information and they're your key to victory. but it does also actually have chips in the game, which is interesting. The right. components are similar, but it plays a little differently.
Right. Yeah. And another that's like a big part of these gotcha sort of bluffing games and deduction games is that it's like always the ability that you don't have is really appealing, because mm-hmm. if it wasn't appealing, who would lie?
Right.
Right.
Or it's either game, appealing or it's necessary.
Is another game that I find their usage of like a currency resource interesting is Citadels. Mm-hmm. Designed by Bruno Faiduti.
Now, and Citadels is a deduction game, but sorry I cut you off, but I do think that Citadels has very little of a social aspect to it.
So here's the thing. Yeah, I guess it's true, is the deduction usually comes from mechanical status and not or in like board state.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just going to say, like, its deduction is interesting because having resources is almost as much of a burden as not having resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting way to look at it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Shifting gears, I'd like to talk about another type of another deduction game, social deduction game, and that is Werewolf. Which is many iterations of the game Werewolf have existed. I think one of the more popular ones right now is Ultimate Werewolf, which was published by Bezier Games and designed by Ted Allspach,
right.
But I think many people are familiar with Werewolf, and if you're not, the gist of it is that there's a group of people. One person is a moderator for the game and does not play. Everybody else has a hidden role given to them, and that role can either be villager or werewolf. And then in Ultimate Werewolf, there's a number of other hidden roles. I think a very common one is seer. And the way the game plays is it plays in a day-night cycle. During the nighttime, everyone goes to sleep. Or they closes their eyes, I guess. The werewolves, who have identified each other, they know who each other are, decide on villagers that they want to kill. And then if there is a seer in the game, then the seer gets a chance to peek at somebody's role. And they get to see whether somebody is a villager or a werewolf. And then during the daytime, the people who are alive and remaining have to vote on who they think the werewolf is. So it's this cycle of people getting voted to be killed, and then people getting voted to be exiled, and then the game... Whoever wins is whoever is remaining at the end of the game, whether the villagers are able to oust the werewolves or whether the werewolves are able to kill off all the villagers.
Right. And this is a much more social game as far as the scale of deduction goes.
Right. I mean, this is one of the games where the social aspect is baked into the gameplay. Like, the day cycle... Right. It tells you to have a conversation during the day cycle and talk to the other players.
Right. And it makes talking to other players a necessity, even, because you'll quickly realize that without any coordination, you won't actually be able to kill the werewolf. Whereas the werewolf immediately kills people, whoever they want. And it's like an oncoming train. It adds this threat. And then it makes it so you know that the threat can only be stopped by cooperating.
Right. But again, just to highlight, the rules are very simple in that there's these hidden roles given out. Each role has a motivation. And the two parts of the game are just one role kills the other. And then everyone votes out a person.
Right. And werewolf, that's it. Werewolf is also very Boolean, for lack of a better term, in terms of how it treats win and fail states. So obviously you're either alive or dead, or, you know, you're a werewolf, you either get killed or you kill. But also, like, as a werewolf, there is no in between whether it's good or bad if people know you're a werewolf or not. Like, they either don't know you're a werewolf, or they do and they will kill you next turn,
or they will oust you next turn.
I think it's lynching usually,
maybe,
but anyways. Or like, if you're a seer, then it's either, you know, you nobody knows you're a seer, or everyone does, including the werewolf, who kills you. You know, it's very like black and white, yes or no sort of situations, which means that there's not very much a time where you want to let people know that you're a given role, but that also means, of course, that you don't want anybody to ever learn accidentally.
Well, that's true, but I think, I mean, in Werewolf, at least, the villager role is the most desirable role for people to believe you to be.
Right.
Just because, I mean, it's kind of assumed that everyone is a villager until proven werewolf or seer. And usually in a game of werewolf, there's the part of the discussion where people will just say that they're villagers just to not get voted out. And, you know, like that's usually a big part of the discussion in the discussion portion, is just everyone just claiming that they're a villager and proving that they're a villager without actually proving that they're a villager. And then, you know, showing their cards.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing that a lot of social deduction games do in general, is they don't have certain rules or like fail safes in place, because it'll socially correct itself. So like, there's nothing saying that you can't lie about being a villager, but also if you do that, then pretty much everybody's going to lie about being a villager, and then you don't know who's actually a villager, and it's back to square one.
Right. If you watch gameplay of this type of game, you will just usually see a lot of people just slinging accusations and then fending them off. And then at that point, it more so becomes maybe, I mean, I don't know. I mean, so social interaction is intricate, and there's lots of levels and layers that you could add to it that you could interpret to discern meanings. Anyways, now one aspect that's unfortunate about Werewolf is that people are eliminated from the game and do not participate after they're eliminated, which, you know, usually in a game you'd rather everyone participated all the way up to the very end, just so that nobody's not having fun. But one game that takes the same setup, where there are villagers and traitors, is a game called The Resistance, where there are it takes place in like a, I don't need to get into the backstory of the Resistance, but essentially there's the Resistance and then there's the undercover agents, and the everyone is assumed to be a Resistance member until proven undercover agent guilty. And essentially, can you hear that plane? There's a plane flying near me.
I can't.
So with these hidden roles, every round, a leader, which is a rotating role, passed around, like you have your hidden role and then one person is the leader every round, goes on a mission, and they assign people to go on the mission, and there is a round of voting whether the people that they've decided to go on the mission should go on the mission. And then the mission happens, and if you are a Resistance member, you have to vote for the mission to succeed. But if you are a traitor for the government, then you have the option of voting whether the mission succeeds or fails. And if the game takes place over five missions, if three of the missions have any amount of failure to them, I think it's that if at least one person votes failure, then the mission fails. So after five missions, if three of them have failed, then the traitors for the government win. And if more than if three of them at least succeed, then the Resistance fighters win. So in that case, nobody's eliminated. Instead, there is this hidden voting process that determines whether the traitors have succeeded or the non-traitors have succeeded.
Right. It seems like this happens a lot as well, where like the whole group has an end condition that's either win or lose, or like a timer that has to be outraced.
Mm-hmm.
So like Secret Hitler is the same way. The I don't even remember what exact terms they use, but the good guys don't want Hitler to be elected. The bad guys want Hitler to be elected. If Hitler's elected, the good guys lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that, where it's like, it's not player elimination. It's a typical everyone wins, or, you know, just a typical fail state where one person or one group is the winner.
Mm-hmm.
It makes more sense for a social game, at least to me.
I mean, yeah, when there's no real like points involved in the game, no like thing that is being scored on a scale, then yeah, that it's you pretty much have to resort to a win-lose scenario rather than like degrees of success.
Right. Yeah.
so
I want to say,
okay,
I want to say another thing, not about Werewolf, but just about these types of games in general, moving on a bit, is that a lot of these will have hard counters in their mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I mean, we talked about how like, so in Werewolf, you can kill people, but a lot of Werewolf variants have like a doctor that can prevent one person from being killed.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a hard counter to the werewolf. And going back a bit further to more mechanically dense games like Citadels or Broom Service or stuff like that, there's usually like roles or abilities that completely shut down another one. Or like Love Letter is another one, where like you can, there are a lot of times where if you play something, somebody has the option to literally just stop it from happening and, you know, reduce your progress. But mm-hmm. that also adds the element to bluff and hide and deduce, because it means that if it's easy to stop you from doing what you want to do, if, again, they have perfect information, then you don't want that to come out and play.
Okay, so it sounds like we're talking a lot about these hidden roles, or...
Right, they give you a reason to keep yourself hidden.
Yeah.
Is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, so let's see. Let's talk about how a game can force you to lie. And right. and you're talking about one example where you have a critical hidden role that you must use carefully because being obvious would make you a target.
Right.
And this exists in a lot of the times in games, especially games where there is a traitor involved. There seems to be a large subgenre in the social deduction genre as a whole that is the Trader Games, where the game hinges around a majority identifying one of the players as a hidden traitor, and the hidden traitor trying to blend in with the majority while trying to progress their own agenda, which is usually against the majority's best interests.
Right.
And there's plenty of games that involve that, and it's pretty easy to imagine what kind of a flavor that kind of a game would have. If you're
subterfuge.
If you're designing a game, you know, intrigue, but also game scenarios that involve paranoia and suspicion of other people. Like I think there's a Salem Witch Trials game, or a Salem Witches. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of werewolf. It's a little, I mean, the genre is a little more historically specific. And there's historical precedence there, but yeah. So that's one way that a game will force you to lie, is it will give you a piece of information that you must keep hidden, because if it were to get out, then you would lose. So you have to lie about what your information is. And you also have to accuse the other players of what theirs are, and eventually try and discern what they are.
Right.
Another way that a game will force you to lie is in this kind of overlaps, at least in the case of werewolf, where it will give you information. It'll give you some information. Well, never mind. I guess this is kind of the same. It'll give you some information that you'll have to keep hidden. But in this case, rather than just giving you the information of who you are, which I guess every game, it's kind of assumed that you know who you are. Sometimes the game will give you the information of who other people are. Usually this won't be enough to actually just straight up win the game. Like, obviously, if you were a player that knew who the werewolf was and you didn't somehow die by random chance by the werewolf singling you out in a game of werewolf and killing you before you had a chance to let it be known, then you could just take out the one werewolf because you know who they are and you would win. I guess it's a little harder than that, because people would have to believe you.
Yeah.
Yeah, people would have to believe you. So there would be that aspect to it. So I guess it's not so cut and dry.
Maybe an example would be like Clue, where you automatically need three pieces of the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know something that other people know, which is what's in their hand, what isn't, you know, the actual murder, whatever.
Maybe even include,
not everybody knows it.
You know what the murder weapon is, right? And so the easiest way in Clue to determine what the other cards are is to make guesses where you know you're not going to get shown any weapons. Like, if you're trying to find out who the person is and you know what the murder weapon is, using the murder weapon is very convenient because you know nobody's going to mess up your responses with other weapons, you know?
Right. But of course, in that case, it's more likely that people will realize nobody has the murder weapon.
Exactly. People will see that you keep guessing the same weapon over and over. And you know, maybe sometime around no cards get shown. And then they'll know just as soon as you know, which is something you want to avoid. So, yeah, that's an example of a game where you are sometimes given pieces of information that you can use to your advantage, but making it too obvious would be a bad thing.
Right.
The inverse of this is also a way to construct a scenario in which players have to lie or be careful about what they say. So in the game Spyfall, players are players are at a location. Most players are at a location. Everyone except one player is giving a card with a specific location on it. The remaining player is a spy, and they are giving no information. And gameplay continues with players asking one another questions that are vague, and they attempt to either suss out details about the location to prove that they know what the location is, or to put the spy in a position where they have to lie, and their lie may give away that they actually don't know what the location is, and then they are outed as the spy. It's like the spy is, in this case, is similar to the werewolf, where they're trying to be discovered for the majority to win. But you have to be careful with the interrogating questions that you ask, because if they give away what the location is too soon, then the spy will be able to know what the location is, and then they'll be able to answer any question as if they had the knowledge to begin with. But of course, if you're too vague, then then nobody will be able to determine like who is a spy and who isn't. So it's a delicate balance that you have to deal with. But in that case, that scenario is constructed just by giving all but one player all of the information they need to know.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, by the way, Spyfall was designed by Alexander Urshan, and they are published. It's published by Hobby World. Let's see. So those are some ways. And then of course there's the BS type game. If you're familiar with BS.
I called it gotcha earlier on.
Gotcha. And that's where you're not given enough pieces to successfully play the game, and so you must lie about what resources you have in order to win.
Right. A lot of hidden movement games are like this.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like Scotland Yard or Mr. Jack, where like you can't feasibly learn, like you can't win the game simply by the mechanical method, so lying and being called out on lies is necessary to actually get from point A to point B, literally.
Mm-hmm. So most of the games that we're talking about so far have been competitive games, but mm-hmm. There are some cooperative social deduction games, although it's sketchy whether you could actually refer to them as social deduction games. So the biggest one that comes to mind is The Mind, which is a game that came out last year. It was nominated for Spiel des Jahres. And it's again a very basic game. The rules are very simple, where there is a deck of cards numbered 1 through 100, and players are given a number of cards. I think the game plays out over a number of rounds, starting, I think the minimum is 8, but you can play up to like 12 rounds. And every round you are given, you start with one card in the first round, and you're given an additional card every other round, or the next round. And as a group, the people playing the game must attempt to play the cards down face up from their hand in ascending order. So the person who has the lowest card plays their card first, and then play continues. And you have to discern when you should play your lowest card, just by it's all entirely nonverbal, and I think the game specifies that you can't use any form of communication, even like blinking or winking or grunting or whatever. It's you can only stare at other people, and that's it.
Right.
Now the game provides some small side mechanics that allow you to I think there's a shuriken card which allows everyone to just play their lowest card face up, that gives away some amount of information that may help the game going forward. And I think you're given 3 mistakes throughout the course of a game, where if you play a card and somebody else has, or any number of players have a card that was actually lower than your card, they have to reveal them, and you lose a life whenever that mistake happens, and you have like 3 lives. And you just try to go through as many levels as you can, and if you can beat, you know, all 8 levels or all 12 levels in a harder mode, then you win. This game is a deduction game. It is cooperative, which I thought was interesting to bring up, but I guess the thing about this game is it's almost antisocial.
Right. Well, a lot of these alternative communication or limited communication games mm-hmm. are deduction games in their own way. You know, stuff like Codenames or mm-hmm. Mysterium, which we just covered. you know, like these games are deduction games because you have to deduce what the other person is trying to convey.
Right.
But they're not like you're trying to hide. It's that you're trying to say something without being able to.
Right. I mean, that's the only way they can force you to obscure the information that you have is by preventing you from actually going out and saying
the
it.
Information. Yeah.
In a cooperative scenario.
Right. Yeah.
Although I think it might be valid to say that it being an antisocial game almost makes it a social game.
Yeah.
It's highlighting that aspect and so it's putting some amount of importance on that aspect.
By removing the big, you know, talking and communication, it brings importance to what's left.
Yeah. I mean, it brings importance to what's left, and it also, I mean, it you still have to socialize some way. You have to communicate some way, and you just have to figure out what that is. In the mind, it's subconscious almost.
Right.
Because you can't actually say that. In other, you know, alternative communication games, there's other ways of constructing new ways of socializing in this game.
Right.
I guess technically you could include games like Concept and Mysterium that make new forms of socializing and force you to do something.
Right. Or Codenames.
Which
Codenames has a competitive aspect, of course, but...
So we've talked a lot about hiding information and lying and tricking people, but there is one, at least one game I know of that uses an entirely different social aspect that's a little more exciting to me personally, and that is what I guess I'll describe it sort of as the fast forging alliance backstabbing genre of game. Whereas instead of giving people hidden roles and hidden allegiances that they must protect and work in the interests for, players are just starting at pretty much the same baseline, I think. And they have to forge their own allegiances and then stab people in the back as they see fit. And the game is set up so that eventually they have to turn on their allies. There's no way for any pair of people to actually win.
Right.
So the game example that I have for this is a game called Dead Last, which is it's a game where everyone is given just a color to identify them, like Mr. Blue, Mr. Pink, kind of like Reservoir Dogs. There's a section of the game where you can talk with the rest of the players however you want. And what you are trying to orchestrate is a vote, to vote one person out. And it's whoever has the majority of the votes after the discussion has occurred and after everyone has voted, whoever has the majority is kicked out. Now, whoever has the majority has the ability to reflect that on those who voted on them. There's like a gotcha or like a deflection card that you could play rather than voting. But I believe playing that card when you are not voted out will get you kicked out. So you have to kind of be certain. But the funny thing about this game is that it's like no holds barred when it comes to orchestrating who you plan on voting for. So you can just, you know, shout, you can talk however you want, say whatever you want, forge alliances with whoever you want. You could also just be as sneaky as you want, you know, passing cards across the table. The voting occurs by using a hand of cards that have on them the colors assigned to all the other players in the game. And so you can like flash those cards at people, you know, pass them behind people's back saying, I'm going to vote for this person. I'm passing you the pink card because I'm voting for Mr. Pink.
I think a lot of like the best or most popular, most well-known social games like this are the ones where you are given a lot of room. There's not a whole lot of like rules or bars on what you can and can't do to convince people or sway people.
Yeah. Like we said, you know, we said at the top, that social deduction games have very few rules, and that especially applies to the socializing in the game. I think in Werewolf, the only rule is that you cannot show your role. Like, you can't actually show what your card says. But yeah. Other than that, you can do whatever you want to try and convince people what your role is.
Right.
That's very fun and exciting. Okay, go ahead.
I want to bring up at least one more type of game.
Okay.
Which I think I've really only seen I've only played in video games, but it counts because it's a Jackbox game.
Uh-huh.
So this is something that Jackbox likes to do, is some sort of social deduction element. And many of their games can translate to tabletop really easily.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, though, I want to talk about Reading the Room, because there's a lot of social games that involve trying to get a read on one specific person, but playing to the crowd itself is also a mechanic of the game. So in mm-hmm. Werewolf, maybe it's not trying to see if one person's throwing accusations towards another person or if one person's super defensive. Maybe it's more so like, what is everybody in the room banding around? What convinces people in general?
Right.
In Jackbox, at least in Party Pack 5, there's Split the Room, which is a game where you have to make would-you-rather scenarios that are as evenly split in terms of how many people would choose either side.
Mm-hmm.
And so that one's like, you can view it as either trying to get each person's individual, you know, personality down, or you can just be like, well, I feel like, you know, based on how it's gone, half the people might like this thing and half the people wouldn't.
Right. That is an interesting distinction to make, is rather than playing person to person or as individuals, you are trying to play the game, or you're trying to design a game that plays to identifying what the crowd. Yeah. The mob mentality.
Yeah.
In a similar vein, there's also Quiplash from Jackbox, which involves coming up with humorous responses to prompts. And that could also involve some amount of reading the room. Just, you know, you want to get the most votes out of the room.
Right.
And rather than making the funniest thing for you or the funniest thing for an individual, you'd want to make the funniest response that the whole room would respond to,
right,
or most people in the room would respond.
In a way, the Game of Things also fits this, which is a board game,
mm-hmm.
where you have to write like an answer to a prompt, but you don't want people to know that it's yours. Because if they guess who wrote a given prompt correctly, they get a point.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't. And in Game of Things, it's important to see kind of what, like, the generic flavor of each prompt is for the whole crowd. Because, you know, even if you only are able to replicate two people or one person, it's better than being completely a sticking out, you know, mm-hmm. sore thumb sort of thing. So that's another one where, like, it's better almost to try to get a general view of how people are approaching the game.
Right. And trying to come up with the most generic. Belonging to anybody response to the prompt. And in a similar vein, Cards Against Humanity or games like that.
For sure, yeah.
Are also a game similar to Quiplash, where
a lot
it's
of
like
call and response games.
Yeah, a lot of call and response games. It can be about being able to, although in that case, I guess maybe not so much. It's not, at least in the mob mentality vein that we're talking about, but because it's individual judges games like Cards Against Humanity, but you are appealing to them and you are trying to discern what their preferences are through the gameplay,
right. Well,
and through the things that they find funny.
A better example would be The Big Idea, where you're pitching products to other players, because that's one where every player votes for who they think their favorite is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And since every player is the judge, it does involve reading the room to see what people would like your sales pitch to be like.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like at the end here, we've kind of stumbled upon another form of sort of social deduction, where the socializing maybe is less of a... I mean, we're not really talking about lying. We're talking about appealing.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Buttering up.
So that's an interesting aspect that could maybe be utilized differently in a social deduction game. What if instead of a traitor, there was a brown noser?
Right. I will say, it's interesting, though, that, I mean, it makes perfect sense, though, that, like, these appealing to the masses are all, like, comedy party games,
mm-hmm.
and the traitor ones are all, like, very serious games, but that makes sense, because if one person's going against the crowd, it makes sense for a more darker tone,
mm-hmm.
both in mechanic and theme, and as well as just how it plays out, mm-hmm. how the room reacts. And a game where you want to make other people happy makes sense for a lighter tone and a lighter atmosphere.
Yeah, although I will say that a lot of these social deduction games make good party games.
Oh, they're, sure.
Just because the rules are simple, and they involve
a lot of people.
They can include a lot of people. They're easily scalable. They involve socializing. Like, they force you to socialize, which is great for parties. Yeah. So I guess the last thing that I want to talk about is how much socializing is necessary to be a social deduction game.
Hmm.
And I think maybe we stumbled upon it that it's maybe not the amount of socializing, but it's the influence that socializing has on the effect of the game, or maybe even the influence that an individual player has on the effect of the game and the influence that socializing will have on that player.
Right. Right. I mean, like, I guess socializing and deducing as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, deduction can go into any game, I think.
Sure.
Any game has an amount. Any game with hidden information will have an amount of deduction.
Sure.
So I think the thing that will separate a social deduction game from a bluffing and deduction game is how much socializing is needed to make the game functional.
Yeah. And even then, I mean, like, if you're going to design a game with the express idea of making it a social deduction game, it's all right to view the social part as a sliding scale. You know, it mm-hmm. doesn't have to have a set aside time specifically so people talk.
Yeah. You would just want to make sure that you are constructing a game that encourages people to keep information hidden from one another. Right. And try and manipulate others to achieve some sort of ulterior goal.
And or a game that encourages conversation in order to reach some sort of goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think, again, like, a big part of when you're designing a game specifically around mechanics is that you want to design your game so that people are coerced into playing the optimal playstyle or the intended playstyle.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you want people to lie and bluff and, you know, convince others and stuff like that, then make rules that lend themselves well to that setup, which is sort of what we just talked about.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, what's your favorite social deduction game?
That's a really tough choice, honestly. I mean, like,
I think I have a pretty solid one.
I have one, but it's probably not what you're going to expect me to say.
Okay.
Which is going to be, of course, Conniving Cooks.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If you were to recommend one to our listeners, though.
Right. For ones that our listeners could enjoy, I mean, obviously the Jackbox games are really good, but if you don't want to play a video game and you expressly want a board game, I don't know.
I would say Werewolves.
I like Game of Things if you want something funny.
Yeah. How about Werewords?
Like Love Letter. Werewords is good, yeah. Werewolf.
Yeah.
Werewolf.
I like Werewords in that it adds the 20 questions. So it's like you're not only trying to discern who is who, you're also trying to just, like, basically discern in what something is in a game of 20 questions. It's like,
right.
Maybe it's kind of even like a brain teaser, like a warm up teaser, like and try to discern this word. Now try and discern the werewolf.
I also like it because it's like trying to do a polygraph test, like a lie detector.
Uh huh.
Because it's like the person who gives the clues can only give yes or no answers, or maybe you're so mm-hmm. close sort of stuff.
Uh huh.
But that means that the werewolves have to ask intentionally misleading questions,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the answer would lead the other players in the wrong direction.
And the way you determine people's roles, other than the moment of conversation that happens at the end of a round of play, is by determining the nature of the questions that they're asking. And right. So in that case, the game is almost like an inverse polygraph test, where rather than judging the responses to questions to determine someone's motives, you're determining the questions themselves. You're right. Determining from the questions themselves.
You know, two things really quick before we end the episode.
Yeah.
One thing is that so a good idea to do if you're learning game design or studying game design is to try to do like exercises on, you know, existing games or in the context of existing games.
Yeah.
I would recommend, how would you fix Clue?
Okay.
So we talk a bit about Clue. Clue is sort of like, it's good, but it's also kind of outdated. So if you're looking for just like a little puzzle or activity, you know, try applying some of your thoughts and ideas on game design to that.
Okay. A little bit of homework at the end of the episode.
The other one is, if you can read it, a bunch of gambling manga is really good inspiration for these types of games. Because the way gambling manga and anime plays out is very similar to the ideal play style of bluffing and deduction and social deduction games.
Okay, so if you're into manga.
If you're into manga or anime, the first season of Kaiji has the best one, which is the rock, paper, scissors on a boat.
All right. Let's see. Is there really quick, I just wanted to shout out that The Resistance was designed by Don Eskridge and published by Indie Boards and Cards. Where Words was designed by Ted Alsbach at Bezier Games, same as Ultimate Werewolf. And I think that covers the attributions of games that we've mentioned, or that I've mentioned at least. I guess I
can't remember everything I mentioned.
We also briefly mentioned Secret Hitler, and Secret Hitler was designed by Mike Boxleader, Tommy Maranges, and Max Temkin, and that was published by Goat Wolf and Cabbage.
Oh, and Broom Service was designed by Andreas Pelikan and Alexander Pfister, mm-hmm. and published by Alaya Games.
Mm-hmm. I guess we haven't done many episodes on social deduction games, but we have done recently one on Dead of Winter, which involves the hidden role of the traitor and possibly deducing who they are. Although, I guess, yeah, there is in Dead of Winter the ability to vote out someone who you think is a traitor. So there is some right. amount of social deduction there.
And the traitor can directly sabotage in a hidden way.
Uh-huh. And we did... Yeah. And Mysterium, which is alternate communications.
We did Concept. We did Broom Service.
Uh-huh. We did Codenames, which is a alternate communication game that we didn't mention in this episode, but it is.
I mentioned it a tiny bit.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess with all that said, that is the end of our episode on social deduction games. Thank you for listening. Yep.
Thank you for listening.
You can go to Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast if you want to hit us up, give us comments, follow us for information, updates whatever, some discussion. You can like us and follow us on any podcasting platform. You can go to bgbcast.com and see all of our episodes organized there with tags. If we mention a game and we give it any amount of review in an episode, we tag it. So if you want to find our episodes for Mysterium, Codenames, Concept, any of the other games that we mentioned in this episode that we've done episodes on, you can find them there with their tags. If you want to go to a URL that we give you the URL for, then you can go to entertainmentgeeky.com, where our friends Chris, Roger, and Jason host a podcast that are all geek and nerd culture related. And you can also go to entertainmentgeeky.com/gear, where you can find their merch and our merch, which includes the game Merle's Truck Stop and Mate. Yeah, I had it right the first time.
Yeah.
Which is a one-page role-playing game that, I've been playing around this whole month, but I'm just going to go out and say it. It's perfect for October. And why not get it now and play it now that it's almost over?
Yeah.
And perfect for Halloween.
On Halloween, yeah.
Yeah, which is coming just around the corner.
Yeah. I also want to say that if you give us any sort of questions on social media, we'd love to do a listener question mailbag episode.
Uh-huh.
You know, just giving us any questions about game design, games, us, the podcast, etc.
Yeah, hit us up so we can compile those.
Yeah. And then one more plug from my end, mm-hmm. which is that I have been streaming on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I've been streaming from weekdays at like 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Central Time. And I think I'm going to be doing one. Well, actually, never mind. But yeah, that's when I stream. I play video games. I've been playing a game called CrossCode. That's pretty fun. And also through there, you can find a Discord server where you can also talk to us through there.
All right.
All right.
And that's the end of our plugs, and that's the end of our episode. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.